Welcome to the Culture of Things podcast with Brendan Rogers. This is a podcast where we talk all things culture, leadership and teamwork across business and sport.
To all our loyal listeners, the Culture of Things podcast will now have specific episodes produced for YouTube. To ensure you don't miss out on this exclusive YouTube content, head over to YouTube, click on the subscribe button, and hit the notification bell. Now, let's get into the episode.
Hello and welcome to the Culture of Things podcast. I'm your host, Brendan Rogers, and this is episode 74. And today, I am speaking with Ethan Mulholland in the flesh. How are you, buddy?
Good, mate. How are you going?
Very well. Very well. Thanks for coming into the studio, buddy. I'm going to read a little bit of your background, and then we'll have a bit of a chat. So Ethan's a 29-year-old Gurindji man from Western Sydney. He's in the process of moving to Canberra to work with the Indigenous Marathon Foundation with Robert DiCostella as the Community Impact Manager. His new role will focus on delivering community programs across Australia through running. He spent the last 3.5 years working at the Glen Rehabilitation Centre, and prior to being an employee at the Glen, Ethan was a client. He's now 4 years clean and sober, and hoping to lead by example and inspire others in making healthier lifestyle choices. Today, we want to focus on Ethan's journey of leading himself from addiction to sobriety. Ethan, official welcome to the Culture of Things podcast.
Thank you very much. Good to be here in the flesh. I heard your podcast, but you know, I'm here in the flesh. I feel very special.
Mate, you're supposed to tell me that you've listened to every and watched every single episode, all 73 episodes before this one.
I'm an honest man. I'm honest. I'll just be honest.
Good on you, buddy. That's what we love here. Genuine conversations, that's what it's
100%,
about.
100%, yeah. That's it.
Good on you, mate. Look, this whole, you know, we're going to sort of get into the whole, you know, leading yourself from addiction to sobriety and stuff, but where are you off to straight after this?
This is my last thing I do on the coast, and I'm out. I'm off the coast for good. Well, not for good, but I'll be back, but I'm going to mum and dad's to stay for a few days, catch up with family before I head off to Ngunnawal country in Canberra to go work with Deeks and then IMF. And so this is the last thing I'll be doing on the coast.
We're honoured, mate.
Right. So am I.
Beautiful, mate. So look, let's unpack a bit of your early history. So pre-alcohol, I suppose. So you grew up in Western Sydney, as you said. Tell us a bit about that, I guess, the early teenage time growing up in Western Sydney. What was that like for you?
Yeah, so I suppose just before I hit my teens, life was great upbringing, played a lot of sport, was a massive rugby league fan, started playing rugby league when I was 4 years old, and I'm not that big or anything, so I was like probably where my knees are now, 4 years old playing footy.
Or grasshopper.
Yeah, they couldn't find the jersey small enough, so my jersey was always up to my wrist, and then but I love rugby league, massive Rabbitohs fan, and idolised Darryl Trindle, Tricky Trindle, so try to dummy, do my little chip over the tops always, and then about 9 years old, I was into sport that much, I was looking for something else to do, and my mum and dad said, what about cricket? And I said, okay, well, I'll try that out. First year, I got selected to play for Penrith. Apparently, I was pretty good at cricket. 2 years later, captain Penrith, played alongside Paddy Cummins, so which is now the Australian captain. And in club cricket, it wasn't as fun because he was bowling 120 Ks and we were like 10-year-old. And I was opening bat, so I was pretty scary. Had a lot of bruises from him.
That's crazy.
Yeah, 100%. And so then cricket and football were my thing, rugby league. I was trying out for New South Wales Emerging Blues, and I tried out for them. And then in the off-season, I decided, because I quit rugby league around when cricket happened, because I was taking that a bit more serious, because I was playing indoor cricket outdoor and I was representing Penrith. Mm. So I gave up footy for a couple of years, but I decided I want to go back to rugby league because I hit high school. So 13, 14 years old, and all my mates are playing rugby league, and I wanted to be cool kid and adult, so I played rugby league, and the club I was playing for was Red and Green. So I was like, well, perfect. There you go. So snapped my arm in the trial match. So I went back, I was going pretty good at footy, and then I was running with the ball, bouncing around like a little jackrabbit, and then I went to go fence on, my arm snapped in half, and I was like, ooh. And then I was in a cast for about 4 to 6 months, and then after that, I don't remember going back to any sport. I suppose that was about year 8, year 9, so about 14, 15-year-old, and started partying on the weekends, started doing what the old, because I always looked up to older kids, and they were drinking and doing their parties, and I was a party at someone else's house, so that became my weekend sport, if you will, and that was what I was up to. So every weekend. From that moment on, when I started drinking, it disconnected me from myself. So from who I really was this person, you know, like sporty. Wouldn't say I was good in school. I was smart, but I just couldn't pay attention much. But I was more into like hands-on, like sport and stuff like that. So yeah, so that age started drinking around Western Sydney. It was just a normal thing to do. So I thought that's what everyone else is doing. And I thought everyone else is doing it. So I had that sense of belonging where I belong with this group, having fun. And I didn't realize how much it was disconnecting from myself back at that age. When I look back on it now, it's like, it makes sense how it all led to it. And then around about 16, 17, the drugs got involved and party drugs every now and then. So you got like the ecstasy and all that sort of stuff. And that was a part of my life. And yeah, so then fast forward to around like 18 and that, and that's when it sort of got a bit more. I was always on and off. So I would have like a rough few months on drinking and using drugs. And then I'll stop myself, but it was just always like a revolving door of like, no, I can stop whenever I want, but didn't know how to. So it was more like I dealt with every emotion through alcohol, if you will. So then that's, and growing up in Western Sydney, I suppose, I didn't know there was much help out there. As I'll get into a bit later with the Glen and all that, I didn't realise there was that help out there. So wasn't aware of it and always thought I could do stuff on my own. I'll be right. And mum and dad always had the answers for me, but me being me, I just never listened and just had to find out for myself. And that's where, yeah, so a bit of a early teens out Western Sydney growing up. It's just a bit of the, I suppose, the culture. It's the culture out there. Every little situation, and that's what I hung around that culture. And I don't blame anyone else around there because I was a part of it. I was the one in that. So it's all it was all my own doing because I had a choice at that age, and that's the path I chose to go.
You said earlier, looking back, you can see sort of where things may have snowballed and whatever. Can you unpack that a bit? Like what were some of those things that, looking back now, you think, you know, were triggers and started to move you on a path that, you know, you're not on now, but it took you down that path for a while?
I suppose I realised I drank differently from a lot of people. I realised stress or going, like I always wanted to be the biggest drinker in the group. And I think I got that title a few times, and just the stresses with life. So from 13, 14 year old, I'm drinking every weekend. So, and then what comes with that is hangovers. And then you're not really yourself the next day or the next 2 days if you drink pretty hard. And then that escalated with problems, say with being unmanageable. So around that age where I started working, I wouldn't turn up all the time. So then I'll feel like crap because I'm not living up to my full potential. So in the best way I know to get over that, what's going on in my head about, and I'm feeling crap, I didn't go to work, is to drink again. And that's how I dealt with that. Party mode, like everything's happy, drink. And that's just where it took me because it led up to what I thought was just going to be fun every weekend. And no, I'll sort my life out. I'm still young. I'm supposed to be doing this. And it led to carrying on for the next 10 to 12 years. So, and I just never knew how to shake it because that become me. My identity is drinking, and then eventually just getting on drugs. And that's how I dealt with everything, ignoring all the head noise that I was going through. So, yeah.
You said earlier too, you I guess there was some influence there. You enjoyed hanging around older people. What was that enjoyment about? Like, why was that so for you?
I think, so I got an older sister and I used to hang out with her friends and all that and all the guys and a couple of years older. So I just thought what they were doing was fun compared to the people in my own age bracket. I always hang out with my older cousin too. So I've always had that older influence and always felt like I matured a bit older for my age. I was getting in clubs at 16. I always just felt like I had to be a bit older and I was just already grew up a bit too quick, I suppose. Grew up a bit too quick. Like, I suppose it, growing up out there, and I just felt like because I was so disconnected from myself when I started drinking, I realized that's who I want to be with, hang around these guys, because I thought it was the fun. It was what I thought where I'd be.
Also, again, want to go back to something. So you broke your arm, and you know, so sport was off the cards for a little while, and you're right into your football, your rugby league, and your cricket, not the real football. rugby league.
Exactly right. That's what I think I corrected before. Because I know that people say football. I'm like,
that's why I'm pointing it out. It's not the real football. It's just rugby league.
Rugby league. Rugby league.
But rugby league and cricket. And again, what I'd like to understand and help our listeners understand in this journey of, you know, okay, the damage to the arm, you know, pretty major damage by the sounds of it. But looking back again, what was that the single biggest thing that you broke your dream, so to speak? You know, that you're on this sort of path and enjoying your sport and whatever, and then a serious injury. Then you said you led down this. But was that the main thing, or was there something else around that point that took you down there?
I suppose that was the start of it, but I think I'd always had a problem with, I think my life was always going to go down that way, either way.
Why do you say that?
I think just because of the culture out of Western Sydney, of what seems normal, the normal culture of being around. So I'm a product of my environment. So if I surround myself with people who are doing that, that's what I'll be doing. I didn't surround myself around people that were just not going out on weekends, who were doing their sport, taking their sport seriously, going through their training. I hung around the people that were, which was, I suppose, the easier option, what I thought was just going out, hanging out with them and disconnect from myself, because I thought as soon as the alcohol and that, as soon as I started drinking, I just felt this is it. This is what the life I want to, this is great. Why isn't everyone else, you know? And then, because it's just the buzz that I got, I suppose it got rid of, like, gets rid of anxiety. I'm out there, I'm having fun, I'm loud, I'm partying. The next day, talking about what we got up to and good or bad things. And that's what I thought fun was. And I think just the alcohol itself, it's, and then that moment just set off. I wouldn't say that's the reason for my downfall, but I think that's the moment I remember, is that when I started falling out of love with sport, because I wasn't able to do anything for 4 months. So sitting there for 4 months, and I'm really, really active, like all ball sports. I'm running everything. I'm just running around mad. So sit there for 4 months, and then I had no resilience, I suppose, back then either, to bounce back from an injury and then to get back into it. I just thought, no, that's too late now. Like I won't make a rep site again. All that self-doubt too. So self-doubt and just not much awareness.
Tell us a bit about maybe what those dark roads look like. You know, you're sort of 13, 14 and you're on a road and leading down a certain way, and it gets darker and darker the further away. What does a dark road look like in that time of, you know, the old Ethan Mulholland?
Yeah, so around the teens where I think it was all fun, it's all fun and games, and I always said to myself, I think when I was like 16, 17, I said, nah, I'll wait till I'm 18 and I'll get my stuff together, you know, I'll get it all together. 18's a good age, and I thought, always back then, I thought, nah, still young. But from 18 to 25, life went like that real quick. Especially when you're drinking and using drugs, life goes so quick. Around 19, you know, in and out of jobs and stuff like that, and I knew I had potential to do something or to do stuff in life, but I just had this drug and alcohol addiction that I just couldn't shake, because for one, I didn't ask anyone for help. I was like that. Never asked anyone for help. I think around about 15, 16, the longest I've gone without drinking a big session, like, is probably 5 weeks till 25 years old. So about 10 years. I remember one time I was 5 weeks off the grog, everything, and I felt amazing. I felt great. I was like, but the easy thing is stopping, like after a big night, it's easy to not, you know, for me to stop. But the hardest thing is staying stopped. And it isn't just about stopping. There's a lot more to it. It's, you know, anyone can stop, but then you can mentally damage yourself if you just got no tools on how to deal with certain emotions or deal with wanting to drink again, like, or that craving, or what's ruining you. You think, you know, I need to drink. So leading down that path about 1920, it's a bit blurry from 20 to 25, to be honest. But the heavier drugs got involved around 20 to 25. And when you're down that road, and like, cause my mum and dad and my sisters and my brother, and they were a great family. So I was too ashamed to tell anyone I had a problem. It was that bad. Some people seen it, some people didn't, but it gets darker and darker because it's like, I'm on my own, where there's heaps of people out there willing to help, but I just never put my hand up for like years. And it gets darker and darker. And then you think, you know, what's my options? And my options, I had a fear of being alive. I used to enjoy sleeping, because what I was dreaming was better than reality. So I'll just always try and sleep, because then I wake up feeling, oh, like, I'm still here, I've got to deal with this stuff, I'm getting nowhere in life, and and then, like, I'm living with mum and dad still, and, like, when I was 13, I had dreams to be here, I'm 25 years old, I'm like, what am I doing? I suppose I had, like, a quarter-life crisis. I always say, like, a quarter-life crisis, like, 25, and it just hit me, and it got dark, and it got to the point where I was either going to kill myself or ask for help, and obviously I asked for help, and my life changed from that. Those three words, I just said, I need help. And then that was, I was actually going to tell my sister, I remember the day, it was January 8, 2018, and it was a Monday, and about 8 a.m., still remember it, and I was pacing up and down the hallway, and I was going to tell my sister, but she went out the backyard, and I was like, and then I was like, no, I'll be right. And then my mum went in her room, and I just went in there and just said, I need help. And then break down. Always get emotional talking about it, of course, but emotional because I'm just so happy that I did that. And, you know, like, broke down, and I was just like, I need help. She's like, what's wrong? I just couldn't even say words. I was like, I need help. And then went off to hospital, got all those checkups and stuff, and then met a guy at a place called Marin Wajali out at Mount Druitt, which is like a drug and alcohol counselling service. And met a fellow named David there, and he was the one who gave me the idea about the Glen. And I was going to that meeting for a counselling session with him. And then my mum was like, come on, we'll go. And I'm like, no, that's right, I'm good now. She goes, get your ass up, we're going. And then I went there, and then my life changed forever. Since asking for help, it just changed from there. And then meeting Dave, introduced me, made me feel comfortable about wanting to go to a rehab to start with, because my interpretation of a rehab was straitjackets, movies, and they're just walking around like that. But that's where my life got to. I was willing to go to a place like that. I was just like, I need help. It's just so hard. Like, for years and years struggling, that's all I had to do is just ask for help.
I need help, very powerful words, and particularly for leaders. Mm. I need help.
Yes.
Again, we're going to go through, you know, a bit about the Glen and sort of the rest of the journey. But you mentioned about you were off the grog for 5 weeks, drugs and alcohol for 5 weeks. What was it at that time that gave you the impetus to actually try and be off it for 5 weeks? Do you remember?
Yeah, because I couldn't hold a job. Couldn't hold a job. At the time, the relationship I was in wasn't going too good. I thought I need to sort that out. And I always knew in the back of my mind it was the alcohol for me. Like, I always knew that was a problem. And I knew if I could get rid of that, things would get at least better, because there's always the cause of things, or it's just the way, because I'm not myself when I'm drunk. And if I'm drunk most of the week, I'm just not me. And at the time, that motivated me, I suppose, the relationship I was in, the and keeping a job, feeling like absolute crap, because I want to go and work, but I just physically, mentally, spiritually cannot get up and just turn my phone off, ignoring everyone. The shame and guilt comes with that. And then I knew if I just get off the alcohol, and then I was going to work every day and I was killing it. And I've always known my own potential, but that sort of motivated me, because the moment I did ask for help, I suppose I was on a long bender and that, but it wasn't the worst drinking or drug session I've ever had that led into it. I had a couple of drinks the day before. I wasn't even drunk when I asked for help. I was completely sober. And I was...
So you were yourself?
I was myself, exactly right. Save me, save me, like, now, go tell your mum. And then, because the little devil on your shoulder, the alcoholic devil, is just like, no, you're right, keep drinking. And then that little angel there had something left in him, and, like, he was probably asleep, and then she probably like, go, do it now. And then, that 5 weeks gave me hope for, like, in the long run. And I always remember that 5 weeks. And then 5 weeks later, I think it was around this time, because I remember it was Easter and I got a gift of beer for Easter. And that one drink, it was like, I'll have a six-pack, it's Easter, you know? Like, forgetting all the stuff that's just happened over the last years, I'm like, that six-pack just looked so delicious. Mm. And I have one, bang, six, and then it's on. And then I'm back to not going.
Someone who maybe didn't know your story, I take it?
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah. Yeah, wouldn't know so much about what I was going through, no way. Knew I was sort of a bit sober, but yeah, sort of didn't, no one ever understood. So it's never like, well, you went there for me. And like, it was like more, I knew what was going on, but I never really communicated it or showed it because I was just always hiding it as well, trying to put on a brave face in front of people. But
again, you said earlier how you were sort of hiding things and whatever. But, you know, family know that something's not quite right. So what was your reflection on, I guess, the awareness of what was happening around you from a family perspective whilst you were, you know, to be fair, damaging yourself and your family?
Well, I spent a lot of time not going home or seeing them or turning up to certain events. And it's obvious when there's like a little birthday party or a christening, you know, Ethan's not there. So it's an obvious thing. But my family always, my pop and my nan and all that, they always had a thing knowing that I'd be all right. And my pop always tells this story that when he was younger, when I was just a bit born, he had a dream about an elder smoking him in his dream and saying, leave that boy alone, he'll be okay. And like my mum's side, my pop's not indigenous, but it scared the hell out of him because he's like, I just got smoked in this dream. And I was a young kid back then, so no one knew what was going to lead up. But he always told me, he said, you'll be all right. I know I got told just let you do your life and you'll come out on the other end good. So, and he always tells me that story, and he's someone who's a bit of a skeptic or whatnot and wouldn't. But this is one thing he always says to me, this is before, man. And the family all knew it. And then when I finally asked for help, it was sort of like, yeah, good. And then that sort of led me to the wonderful place of the Glen Rehab.
I think people would want to know, certainly I want to know as well, is what did you feel you didn't have in that 5 weeks? That I understand that action of, okay, here's a six pack and whatever, but what again, in hindsight, beautiful thing, on reflection, you didn't have around you that you needed to make a different decision, even when the six pack was in front of you?
100%. People that are in recovery as well. So I didn't have people that have been in that position before. I had no one to call up and say, look, I've got a six pack in front of me. I don't want to drink it, but it's there. I didn't have, I suppose, the tools, I suppose, of recovery of like, where's it going to lead me? You know, I sort of knew where it was leading me, but it was sort of just subconscious, like bang, open, crack. But I didn't have, I suppose, the connection of others. I didn't have someone like a mentor. I didn't have a mentor or anyone to say to me, say, hey, look, you're sober for 4 to 5 weeks. Make sure, you know, when Easter comes, like you call me up before if there's anything like that. And these days it's like I've got people around me. I hear stories of others, same story as me, that I can relate to, and then there's my connection and there's my mob of people that I need around me. So I got all these tools of obviously working in a rehab for one as well, like learning about people's stories, learning about myself, my triggers, which is like my worst fear was not thinking that I'll be able to have fun without drinking, because I was every Friday night was like it's party. So then first few Fridays in rehab were really hard. Because, like, it's Friday night and I'm like, my body clock is like, where's the alcohol? What are you doing? Where's the party
where's
at?
Where's the fun?
Where's the party at? And then I was like, but then 2 weeks later, I forgot what day it was and I was going really well. And then I realized I'm going really well when I'm not focused on what day it is. Back to what didn't I have, I suppose, the tools to know and some people around me that have been there before. That's probably what I didn't have back then.
So what took you then to that famous decision on the 8th of January 2018 to say, I need help?
I think I realized I couldn't do it on my own anymore. I was suicidal, like because it's, I had the Christmas, that's right, I had Christmas on 2017. So I felt like absolutely crap because I'm in no position to get anyone presents. I'm probably 10 kilos less than what you see now. So I spent that drinking with mates, ignoring my family, because I was too ashamed to go there. New Year's Day, massive bender. And the next six, I suppose the next, from January 1st, that was just drinking cocaine. And then I just got to the point where I had a fear of being alive. I was like, I want something to take me out. I was always too scared to just go and do it. I remember I was just driving around, running the muck and just hoping something will take me out. I was just, I can't do it. And then I woke up January 8th having a fear of dying. So I went from a fear of being alive, like I don't want to be here, then that sleep on the lounge room in mum and dad's house, waking up, and then that little angel say, you're not going to die, let's go.
Tell us a bit more about that, I guess, can I say the next 48, 72 hours from that day, I need help.
For sure. So straight to the doctors. Doctor sent me straight to the mental health at Nepean, at Penrith. And me being me, I was like, because I told someone, I felt great. This huge weight just come off my shoulders. I was like, oh, I'm all good. And then because I'm on a high, I'm speaking to like the nurses or the doctors. I'm speaking to them like I'm all good now, you know, like, which I thought I was good at the time. And I was just saying, yeah, no, it's all good. And then I was waiting there and then they interviewed me. I was like, I'm good. And I think I was just worried or not. I was just not bothered to do more work about it. Like, okay, I've told someone I need help. And I thought, and then the lady speaking.
They had other ideas.
Yeah. But actually, at the time, from that moment on, like, I was completely like off the grog, nothing. Like, I just said, nah, it's done. But that's what I mean. Like, that 5 weeks where I was off it being great, and then got to like a week of me being sober. And then I was just doing nothing with my life because I didn't want to go back to doing what I was doing for work. Because I suppose the culture of that too was alcohol and drugs everywhere. And I couldn't put myself there. I just had no purpose in life either. So it's fair enough that I stopped and I need help, cool. But what do I do now? Do I just sit at home and just bum? And it's only a matter of time before I decide drink's the best idea as well. So the next 48, 72 hours was getting that therapy sessions and then speaking to someone at Mount Druitt, which was David, which led me into there about a week later, where I'm glad mum and my old man got me into it because that was the next step for me to getting more help. You know, without that, it would have been pretty hard. But I was led in the right direction, which unfortunately it's hard. A lot of people don't have that support around them either. So that's why I hope this can reach out to people to find the right people. Mm. If someone's watching it as well, that realise, you know, there is help out there, a lot of help. You just got to reach out.
So from there, being in the hospital in the Nepean area, Nepean Hospital, and the mental health unit there, what's the next process and where does the Glen come in for you?
Yeah, so then 3 weeks later, I'm at the Glen, just like that. So I applied for the Glen. When he was explaining to me, I was like, I don't want to go to rehab, or it's like for 12 weeks. I said, oh, 12 weeks is it's a long time. And I had all this fear of like what I'm going to miss out on. And I sort of just felt myself, I'm like, you idiot, like, who cares if there's a public holiday coming up? I'm like, you got no money anyway. What are you doing? Like, I'm like, that's the moment I had to say, look, everything's off the table. Mm. Like, who cares whose birthday it is coming up, whose birthday or Christmas, or I've got to be there for that. I need to save myself here because I won't make my next birthday if I don't get this right.
So you really had to make a decision to focus on yourself.
Yeah. I had that self-awareness just kicked in. It's just like, dude, like, the conversations I had with myself completely changed from asking for help. And then just looking into the Glen as well on the website, I was like, this is perfect. Culturally, like, they do dancing, they do the art. Like, it's just, this is what I need in my life. To go somewhere where I'm just taught things and that all the stuff that I ignored from my parents years ago, you know, all that little how to apply for a job and just the small things in life that I just I ignored because I was just, my mates were doing that. But yeah, so it led to the Glen on the 24th of January. So, and then that was on a Wednesday, I'm pretty sure. So I remember that very clear. I've got a bad short-term memory, but I can remember it was 28 degrees Celsius. No, I don't know.
Significant moments in your life, mate. You probably should remember these days.
Yeah. And then got the bus up. When David was telling me about the Glen, he goes, oh, it's only up the road. I'm like, I'm not going up the road. I'm like, I'm from here. I'm not going to. But up the road in his language was an hour and a half. Got on the bus with another lad that was going in there that day and absolutely crapped myself. Like, I'm about to go into a facility, rehab. Like, on the bus, I was like, wow, my life's really got here, you know? Like, I'm going to rehab. Like, because there's a stigma attached to it, right? Like, I felt embarrassed, but also proud at the same time. Like, I don't care what anyone thinks. Like, I need help. I'll be more embarrassed if I don't go and do this. And the bus trip up. And I was met by one of the counsellors, Maddie from the South Coast. And it was just so welcoming and warming. And the first few hours, man, it was amazing.
What was it about it?
The people that were there, the workers, the clients that are there at the time, because we're all going through the same thing. And all they just showed me around. They took me on a tour. They go, mate, you're in the right place. Like, what's your poison? What are you? I'm like, oh, the grog, and then there's like 20 blokes there just saying, like, because it's exciting when a new fella comes in, like, yeah. It's like, because they know it's changed them, and they know this dude walking through the gate now that's completely damaged. He's gonna get in a shock of his life. And that Wednesday night, there's a meeting around the fire, and I was just like, whoa, wow, like, because it's just honestly like how we're having a yarn now, just lads telling the story how I'm doing it around the fire. I'm just like, that's my story. This guy's been here 10 weeks. He's clean and sober. He's just gave me the solution to what's been bugging my mind about, like, you know, whatever it may be. But I walked out of him. Like my spirit came back, and I'm just like, this is the place to be. And then a week later, I'm out there dancing in front of 7,000 people, Sydney FC, and I forget who it was, at Central Coast Stadium, painted up, shaking a leg. And I remember the phone call to my mum to go tell her to meet me there because we could invite family. And and I remember the phone, she's like, what happened? Like, I'm like, no.
Mum.
I said, listen, she goes, are you okay? I'm like, yeah, of course, mum being mum. And and I said, yeah. I said, look, I said, she goes, how are you? I said, honestly, I said, I'm, and she could hear it on my voice, like, I'm having the best time. Like, I never ever thought I'd be like, oh, I'm gonna have a great time at rehab. Like, and then invited her out and painted up, and that was really important for me too, to get back into culture, Aboriginal culture, my heritage, you know, like, make my nan proud, you know, like, my dad. So just to paint up on ochre and then dance in front of 7,000 people, you'd think you'd be a bit nervous, but as soon as that paint comes on, the ochre, it's just game day, you know, like, it's...
What was it about that experience that, you know, made it so good for you?
The dance?
Yeah.
Well, back to my heritage, it's who I am. It's my identity. I wasn't born to be an alcoholic, you know. That's not me. That's alcohol. That's the bad spirit. This is the good spirit, you know. So drinking spirits, painting up Mother Earth and dancing for, not for others, and dancing for me, to my family, my mob. It's the first time I've ever done that too. Well, like, I had chances to do it younger and all that, but growing up around that way, you sort of, that's the culture, is the drinking, like, that's what the way I went then, drinking culture. And but it's just, it's like when I finish a good run today, you know, like when I do a lot of running, I feel like that endorphins are pumping, but the dancing is like mental, physical, spiritual, all three in one. And then to do it in front of 7,000 people for one of the first times ever was special, and I won't forget that ever.
Our interview will continue after this. An expression of gratitude or reciprocity, no matter how large or small, is an important part of a healthy culture and relationships. Our friends at Jangler have a great app that allows you to send a gift card with either a personal video, voice message, or funny GIF. You can send it right away or schedule to send on the perfect day and time, so it can be something you set and forget. It's perfect for clients, employees, birthdays, and any celebration where you can't be there in person. It's quick, easy to send, and you can spend instantly in-store or online when you receive a card. Check it out at www.jangler.com.au. That's www.jangler.com.au.
Where does that identity get lost? I mean, again, there's drug and alcohol problems in society across the board. In Australia, there is unfortunately a bigger problem in the Aboriginal community. Where does that identity get lost, and what are we not doing there that, you know, is creating this environment that, you know, is not helping the Aboriginal community moving forward?
Yeah, well, for me, it's as soon as the alcohol was just, as soon as it touched my lips, it was just like, it's not me. I knew it wasn't me, but the damage it can do, where, like, it was only introduced into Aboriginal culture, it was not even that long ago. So where it's all new and the lowest life expectancy in the world, the Indigenous culture, so got all this other stuff like certain foods, and it just wasn't a part of it. So when you're putting something into your body that's not meant to be there, your body's going to react a different way. And preventable measures, I suppose, like, prevention is better than the cure as well. So the youth, which is like, try and get into the someone where I was when I had that road where I could choose, the Indigenous youth, to sort of give them more opportunity in areas where alcohol isn't an option, which is hard because there's bottle loads every 2 kilometers. So it's and it's acceptable more than anything else. But it's at the end of the day, it's a cause of a lot of deaths, health issues. So I suppose the best thing I can do for myself is to lead by example where it could take you, and just hopefully spark someone's mind to not make those decisions, especially in the Indigenous space as well. There's a whole opportunity, there's great life out there, and alcohol doesn't need to rule it.
That the Glen Rehabilitation Program, that first 12 weeks, what was it there that gave you the confidence and the sense of identity and the self-belief that you are building this foundation? Because again, this is where personal responsibility comes in, isn't it? That you're there, you're building foundations, there's some things happening. What was it that started to create that for you and to kick in?
I think because you got structure, routine. So you're waking up, you're making your bed. Couldn't remember the last time I made my bed before that, to be honest. And just being straight honest, then I actually didn't even know how to work the washing machine because
Sounds like your mum's too good to you, mate.
Well, this is a funny story. I always tell everyone, my roommate at the time, Steve, God love him, he was great because he was real talkative. Like, he can talk. But I sort of was ready because I was ready to get in there, and I was observant, and I was a sponge. Like, I was absorbing all this good stuff, you know, where I fed myself
you
all this.
Knowledge.
Yeah, knowledge. And I was ready to hear it, and I'm really observant. And I was like, man, can you show me how to use this washing machine? And you press 2 buttons, you put it in, and then press the button. I was like, is that it? Sorry, mum. I was like, I put it in. I'm like, oh, wow, that's it, you know? And then those little small things that I did, the small things that, like, structure, routine, eating, training, physical, mental, spiritual, telling people about how I'm feeling for the day, I just build on that and every day. And then I actually did go to rehab to learn how to drink properly. I thought I was going to go there and, like, you know, I'd be able to have a couple. But for me, it's never a couple. And why would I want that couple? Why would I want to drink to anyway? If it doesn't go good for me, why to socialize thing? But I learned how to socialize without having to do it. And it's hard. It is hard, but it's what I've got to do if I want my life to go the way I want it to go. Building on those, learning those things like that, and absorbing all the knowledge from the counselors, watching how they do things, watching how Shane, watching how Alex and Joe, watching everyone and saying, these are the guys, because I hung around people that back in the day that I was around, I wasn't the best influence myself either, but I was doing that. And I thought, if I can put all that energy and stuff into what they're doing, I'll become like them, and I'll be able to get the opportunities like them. And then the 12 weeks I was there, then I got to transition. So that's where I also told David that, he goes, oh, at the rehab for 12 weeks, you can also have an opportunity to live on site. I'm like, I'm not living in there. I'm getting 12 weeks. I'm coming back home. Like, what? Had no idea what I was in for, and it was good because stayed there for 7 months at the Glen and built more on the foundation. So the transition program is where you do the 12 weeks and you stay longer. You stay longer to go to work, get tickets. So then I went up to the Butchers up the road, got a start there. My second day in transition, put myself. I said, got into work, and then I started that Friday. I think I went up on Tuesday or Wednesday, and then I started Friday. And I had no idea it was the meat that got delivered to the Glen. So I was like, oh. So then they must have rang Joe or something. Like, and I've got to start just because I'm linked in with the Glen. So they gave me a go, and I'm forever grateful for them at Murphy's at Chitterway. And I started working there. And when I was working as a butcher, I realised, because I used to do butchering back in the day, and I realised, that's not me. I said, I need to be helping people. Like, I felt like I was put here to help others. And I quit that job, and I said, look, I had no idea where I was going to go next, but I always wanted to work at the Glen. And I planted the seed in Joe's head or everyone else. I said, if you need someone to work here, I'm keen. And then I got 2 days a week. So they tried me out. And a few weeks later, 4 days a week. And then within a month, I was full time. And then but I had to move out because I was working at the rehab while I was living there, getting a bit of work with them there. And then got my first ever place on my own, bought my own car, all those things that I should have done many years ago. And then, yeah, come February 2019 is when I was full-time at the Glen. And then, yeah, just thinking about it now, it happened so fast. because I thought I'd go out for a few years and come back and work. But I was there within 8 months working there and taking the guys on outings, doing events, you know, one-on-one yarns with them. I know how the program works. I observed all the workers before. I'm like, well, I'll take a bit of you, bit of him, bit of her, how they approach people and how they deal with things. And always, like, if I don't know how to deal with things, I'll find the right person to do it as well. So it's all those things I picked up on and then progressed, and then, yeah.
What do you think Joe saw in you to give you that opportunity at the Glen? Because it's not an opportunity that comes to everybody.
Yeah. Well, he always tells me I took some people on a tour of the Glen, and he didn't know much of me. He only probably heard a bit about me, didn't know much of me. And he always says that I went on tour and I did most of speaking, and he said, I knew more about the Glen than him. He goes, he was really impressed of how he was blown away about this. Who is this guy? Like, what's this guy? He knows, like, because I learned about the Glen and the culture and why it's there, it means something. And then I took people on a tour, and I had no idea he was even watching at that time, but I was just so proud of what the Glen done, and I'd share about how it started, I'd share about what the fire means, I'd share a bit about my story in between, make a few people laugh, make them feel welcome at home. And he seen that, and then planted a few seeds, and then I think my first job at the Glen was to make about 100 sets of clapsticks. And I'm not really good with woodwork, but I made it happen. I did it because I was just happy to be there and happy to be working for them. So 100 sets of clapsticks, and then it got to, like, taking the guys to touch footy, like taking them to the beach. Not bad, you know.
Tough gig, mate.
Yeah, tough gig, yeah. Taking them to the beach on outings, going sports games. But that's what works. Like, it's not about, like, you know, giving them 8 hours of therapy and just documenting. It's bringing these fellas back to life again. And now with the women's opening up, doing the same for them. So
absolutely exciting times.
Yeah, very exciting.
I guess it's similar to what you're saying. You know, there's another life outside of maybe what you've always known, and putting people in that sort of situation to go to the beach sober, you know, to be involved in some cricket or, you know, whatever. Some of these guys and maybe girls have never had that opportunity, I'm guessing.
100%. So, like, the routine, like, covers, like, you got music, art, sport. And with the Glen, it's real flexible. So if someone came up to me and said, I want to start doing poetry, us as workers, we'll get them poetry lessons. Like, we'll do it. Like, that's what you want to do. And musicians come in there, and then they always think, you know, how am I going to play without drinking? We've had some musicians come in, and then we do, like, a Glen's Got Talent show, which I've always dodged,
You've got talent?
Yeah. I was like, well, do you want to run around in circles for, like, 3 hours or, like, singing and that? So I've dodged all that. They're going to laugh at that. But there was a singer, a great musician, man, and he performed for the first time sober in front of everyone for a while. But giving people, like, community, like, volunteer work, cleaning up the waterways, graffiti removal, helping our neighbours out, you know, just doing those things that give us a sense of worth. Like, you know, I've helped someone today, and that's what I always try and strive to help others. And bringing them back to life, that's what it is. Some guys grew up on the beach, salt water, and they haven't been in the beach because they're too ashamed, because that's culturally for them, it's where they should be. And then they get clean and sober, and then they go on a little beach trip that everyone thinks, oh, well, 5 minutes from the beach, what of it? But to him, it means a lot, because that's what he used to do, and then he's connecting back with himself.
During your time at the Glen, and even from being an employee of the Glen, so take the client and the employee perspective, what has been the most significant challenge that you've come across personally?
The biggest challenge would be going from client to staff member, because the biggest challenge was, because when I went done that, there were still people I went in the program with that were as a client, and now I'm a worker, and then now I've got to tell them certain things to do. So I suppose that was a big challenge, but I think I was just that buzzing that much that my life was going so good. Like, the biggest challenge I could see was just doing that, like going from client to staff member real quick, and my life happening. Like I said, I grew up pretty fast. I thought I did. So my life was always going full steam ahead, always. So I think I did that, and a few months later, that got easier.
I guess in an organisational world, it's almost like being the team member, then going to be the supervisor. So what worked for you as far as managing that transition, that process?
Speaking to people like Shane and all that, and like, how do I deal with this? Mm. And also delegating certain things, because over the next 3 months, clients will start leaving. And then within the next 3 months, there'll be a whole bunch of new guys there. So they don't know that I was a client 3 or 4 months ago.
Yep.
So those, but I always told myself, me being me, those clients that were there when I was there and I was working there, I'll still, they're my mates. They're my brothers. Like, and if something got too difficult, I always ask Shane or someone, how do I deal with this? And just ask for help and how to deal with it all. And I just dealt with it and just said, but usually the Glen's that honest and things get sorted straight away like that. So it's not an issue for too long, but it's, it was pretty easy because they were all happy for me too. Like, they come through and so they're all happy and buzzing that I was, you know, I'm working there. And but my role wasn't, they didn't give me a role, the Glen, to be in a position where it could happen either. So I suppose, yeah, just the work environment, the work culture at the Glen with the people there, it's like I said, it's a family. We argue. Everyone, you know, doesn't get along, gets along. 1 minute we, you know, we'll argue with them. Next minute we're going to dinner with them outside of work. It's a really strong family atmosphere there. And I suppose it's just honest conversations. Just, okay, yeah, and it squishes straight away.
How about, again, your own journey of being a client at the Glen and then become an employee? How do you think having that client experience, you know, what have you remembered through your experience and then sort of coming in, how has that helped you be a better support person for the guys in the program today?
Well, there's one word that I think everyone needs if you're working in that field is empathy. And you need to care how others feel. And I know how they feel in certain situations because I've done the program. I've been through certain things they've gone through. Not always, but I understand how they feel or what time. Like, you know, they've been here for a few weeks, they're getting like this. I'm always thinking, you know, because sometimes their behavior's not so good, but it's never like someone's left a bit of spilt milk on the table. Like, what else is going on? Like, because you can walk past that when you're going well. You're like, oh well, it's only milk. But when you're having a really crap day and someone spills milk, you want to, you know, who done that? Who done this? And so empathy, wondering, knowing how others feel and then sorting it out with them. I think that's what one of the strengths I got from when I started working there, understanding the clients. I know where they're at most of the time. And I can sort of see it in their face, and I know they're, yeah, so empathy. And I think it's a big thing just in general. I think everyone should care how others feel a lot. So that's, I think, one of my main things. I love always thinking how others feel and then, yeah, always cautious of that.
So you finished with the Glen only last week, last Friday.
Yes.
And have you had a chance to look back and think, well, is there any regret? Is there any regrets for you? And I don't mean about leaving the Glen. You haven't had time to regret and you haven't started your new role yet, which we'll go into. But just in your experience there, like what's a situation that you wish you could have impacted on or changed or whatever?
So like something that I might miss or?
More whether it's been a, you know, maybe a situation where you felt that it didn't, you wish you could have done X to maybe change the outcome. That might have been in your own journey. It might have actually been in a client's journey as well. We really, you know, I think in hindsight, I could have done this to really help and it might have made a difference. You know, what sort of regret do you, if any?
Yeah, well, I think what comes to my mind when you say that is just the guys I'm working with, I've been working with for the last, I suppose, 2 to 3, 4 months, because you come attached and you help them from day one. You sort of, there's no...
This right is the clients in the program.
Clients in the program, yep. Yeah. So some of them have been there for a few weeks. Some of them have been there for 6 to 8 months. So I know them all very well, every single one of the clients. So it's thinking like, oh, I'll help this guy do this and then I'll leave. But it's going to be hard to leave there. And it has a very hard place to leave, especially when I went from where I was at, like I said earlier, to where I was and what the opportunity, all the opportunities the Glen gave me. To leave that is probably the hardest thing is not continuing working with them guys and helping them still kicking off some goals that they've got coming up. But I trust in the Glen and the workers that are there now. So, but told all the guys, if you need me, I'm still here. If I don't answer, I don't want to be on the phone today. I don't want to be on the phone today. Simple as that. So don't, nothing personal. Text me. I'll call you when I'm ready. But yeah, so the hardest thing, I suppose, what I wish, you know, like a regret, probably be like, oh, I wonder how he's going. But I know they'll be fine. I know that'd be good. And I watch from afar from the Facebook page at the Glen. They'll text me. I get some random messages from guys 3 years ago because I let them all know that I'm leaving the Glen. And then just all the comments refresh my memory of what I have done for them and what they've done for me, because it's how it works. Help them, seeing them thrive. Empathy, see, I know how they feel when those little goals get ticked, when they work the washing machine, you know, when they when they press that button. I'm like, yeah. I know that feeling.
I mean, they're little goals, but they're big goals in that journey and the perspective that you can offer. You know how big those sort of things are in life.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, there's little, you do the little things right, and then big things come a lot easier. But they got to be done, those little things, you know, and sometimes we don't know what we don't know. So I always tell people that, and I always tell people about the washing machine thing, because if I didn't know how to do it, I don't know. But when people are embarrassed about how they don't know how to read or write, or they don't know how to do this, like, I can't even swim. I can run and play sport, but I'm not a good swimmer. And I told the guy, I said,
is this why you don't take us up on the offer to swim down in Terrigal?
100%. That's exactly right. Joe, Ziggy and all that try to drag me down.
Everyone's trying to get you down there.
They try to drag me down. And I got for, I think for Christmas or my birthday last year, I got some floaties. So everyone always buys me floaties.
You can always count on your mates, can't you?
Yeah, of course. But that's the person. I love a little dig, a little sly, a little digger at everyone. And grew up where I grew up, you've got to have thick skin. Got to have thick skin out there, because otherwise you'll just break. But, you only know what you know. And, so hopefully Canberra will learn how to swim. I'll come down and come down.
You're going further inland, mate. You know that, don't you?
Yeah, I know. There's no water much there. See what I'm doing? See what I'm doing?
And stuff. I know you are. So let's go into that, because you're moving to a role with the Indigenous Marathon Foundation, as we said in the intro, working with Rob DiCostella. Fantastic opportunity. Well done. How has running become part of your journey? How has that helped you in your journey?
So, and it all come from the Glen as well. So the only reason why I found out about the marathon, Indigenous Marathon Project, was through a fellow named Chris, who I work with, and he's really enthusiastic. And he's like, mate, you gotta, do you want to go to New York? And I was just like, what are you on about? And he goes, mate, Indigenous Marathon. He goes, how old are you? I said, I think I was 27, and he's like, oh, and I'm looked into it, and I'm like, wow, what an opportunity. And then, I hated running. Like, I love running around with sport, but I always never grasped the thought of people just running with no, like, you can't score, you can't kick, because I was like a sprinter. And so then I was like, but you know what, it's not about the, it's not even about the marathon. Marathon's cool. I said, it's the opportunity to get my story out there even more about where I've come from. And I felt like if I can train for a marathon within 5 months, never ran more than, I think, 10K it was or something like that. If I can train for that in 5 months and get it done, and I'll show these guys at the Glen, clients that I was where they were, I can do this, I can do that. It sends a message of hope. And like, not that they have to run a marathon, but anything. Like, I've come from, you know, wanting to kill myself to running my first marathon. And so Chris gave me the idea. I tried out for it. I applied. Just gave him a brutally honest story. With like a 5 kilometer trial run up in Newcastle, and it was like 38 degrees. And the night before, I was eating Cheetos. I still remember these little
events. No one spoke to you about preparation.
I knew very well, like, playing sport, but I was just like, I don't know why. I just ate it, and I didn't even bring any water. And I drove up to Newcastle, and then Adrian, coach, is, I'm looking at him, I'm like, yeah. I'm like, I can do 5K easy. There's 12 laps of, I think it's like 4K, I think 12 laps of cricket over up there. And ran around, and Cheetos started coming up a bit. I was like, hold it down. But I didn't stop. I went the whole way, didn't stop. But like, I was just pale white because I was just ready to vomit. And I didn't. And then told him my story, and then told him I'm from the Glen. And he was going from Newcastle to Sydney for the next trials. And I thought, this guy has to go past the Glen. I'll show him the Glen. And then showed him, took him on a tour like I did, like Joe says, with that tour. And like, you're at the Glen, you've been around the Glen. And took him on a tour, told him my story, and I said, this is me, blah, blah. And then a few weeks later, I got a call up, and you're running a marathon. It's supposed to be in New York, but COVID. But what was even better, we got to run our first marathon in Alice Springs under a full moon, midnight marathon on Halloween.
Wowee.
Yeah.
Some experience.
Crazy experience. And then, you know, that, and that's just, Chris gave me the idea, and then, like, I'm like, great opportunity. I can do that and make my family proud. They're seeing someone who was how he was, now he's in the middle of the country just running a marathon, also throwing his guts up in the middle of Australia under a full moon. Like
Fertilizing,
yeah, that's it. Yeah, giving him, you know, fertilizing the ground there because it's a bit dry there, so I thought I'd give him a bit of liquid. You know, while it was dry, it was crazy experience. It was crazy in a good way. Beautiful. And we got to go to Yundamu and camp under the stars 2 days prior. Yeah, and there's all these opportunities that come. And this is, literally from giving up the grog and giving up all that stuff. Mm. Opportunities come, surround myself with the right people, and opportunities come away and I grab them and I'm confident. I'm not, like, my confidence and my trust in people that, you know, this is the way to go.
So now this next chapter of your journey, I said going to the Indigenous Marathon Foundation and you know, leading over there. You also mentioned before how you didn't really enjoy running for the sake of running. I'm with you, mate. I've never been a huge fan of it, but for some reason we're more into running now. What is it that's, how has that come about? Like what has that process been to, you know, not liking that, but then now it's part of your DNA.
Yeah. Now I'm doing ultra marathons and
you're a nutter.
Yeah, I know this.
Because something about the Glen. Yeah. Everyone comes in, they just come out nutters. They want to run 10 marathons in 10 days and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, that's. I think he's doing that next week.
What is it? Like, what is it that plants that seed that just says, you know what, this is now just part of me?
Because, like, when I first started running, so we got our first training schedule and I think it was like 3 or 4K, run 3 or 4K on a Wednesday, just easy. But me is like, no, I'm not running easy. I'm going to sprint this 4K. And I said, and I burn out after like 700 meters. And I was just like, why? This is going to be hard. I'm like, what have I signed up for? I'm like, man, I want to do this and prove myself something and help others. Okay, but man, I really want to pull up. I'm like, no, I'm not. I was so used to starting and not finishing things back when I was younger. I did like, always started like a boxing lesson and I won't go back a week after, Muay Thai and all that. I do all these things, but I just always start and never finish. I said, then it's like the conversation I had with myself. I said, no, we're getting into this. Find out why you're burning out. Call up the coach, someone that's been there, knows more than me. And I just learned to pace myself. It's all in a rhythm. Like it's all, I'm not trying to, like who am I? I'm not racing anyone. Like I'm just run, enjoy. And I had headphones in and they broke. And it's the best thing that ever happened because now I'm great without music. And I was like, they broke it 3 weeks in because I was just buying like a Kmart pair, I think, $15, and they broke. And I was like, okay, well, I have to run without it because I've got to get this training in. And then I'm pacing myself and I'm like, oh, this is actually pretty good. I can breathe. And it's just all rhythmic. And they're just telling me all these little analogies. It's like one of the analogies that stuck out, and it's like when you're running, it's like a bucket of water and you're slowly just tipping from it, just slowly tipping from it. If you tip out straight away at the end, or straight at the start, you got nothing left. Pour the rest out when you're near the end. When you got nothing left, keep smashing that bucket. And I fell in love with it because I learned how to do it properly, not just enough fan. Like, and then the endorphins and the people you meet, the places you go. So, and I thought running, you wouldn't be spending much money because you're just running. I mean, watch shoes, gels, all this magnesium, all this stuff you spend the money on, and just the people you meet, like it's you run, you sweat together.
We should have had some of your sponsorships on the table, mate.
I haven't got a sponsor. If anyone wants to sponsor me,
we'll sort it out.
Cool. It's just the people that you meet and run with, running groups, like there's that sense of belonging again. So, like, you know, I've got my running thing, I've got my recovery friends, I've got my family, I've got the Glen, the IMF.
Really sort of building this community around you.
Yeah, yeah, and just with positive people. And I still got my friends that, you know, that I grew up with and, you know, I've got some of them help and now they're doing good as well. And and all my friends there, they know they can reach out to me whenever they want, if they need me. You know, like, I love them all. I just can't be around that area for a bit, going doing my thing, representing Western Sydney around the world and country through running and being me and showing people that people from out that way can change their life and make something for himself.
What are you looking forward to most with your new opportunity at the IMF?
What I'm looking forward to is learning how they just operate. Like, it's they're on a national scale, so they're around the country. Just how they, why they're doing it, I know why they're doing it. How they just make it happen. Go the ins and outs. So I just do what I do with Glenn, observe everyone, see what they do, and learn and give my best, and just hopefully help others. So it's train for their marathon now, like I did with the Glenn, help them through their recovery. Now learn everything I can just to give back. At the end of the day, I'm someone, if I get knowledge, I just can't wait to share it or teach others. And so I'm looking forward to most is learning on how they do it, because I'm coming from drug and alcohol space to a completely different, I suppose, different space altogether. So it's that's what I'm looking forward to, learning something new.
How do you hope to inspire others who have, you know, experienced a journey like yours, maybe not in Western Sydney, in other parts, but what does that look like for you? How do you hope to inspire others who are, you know, on a path which has got some dark roads on it to seeing the light, so to speak?
I think just with my actions and how I carry myself, I don't go telling people how to do things if I'm not doing that at that time, you know. Like, I think just, I suppose, sharing my story and telling people that they know there's hope out there, there's help out there, and just by my actions, just this is what I've done, this is how I'm doing it, this is how I carry myself, I help others, and it can be done no matter how, because there's a part there when it's dark, you think nothing can save you, you think, nah, like that's it, like it's too much work or it's that, but that word, you know, the word work, that you need to do all this work, it's just a day-by-day thing. I always thought I'd stop drinking forever. And then someone said, don't think of it. You're going to give yourself anxiety. Don't worry about what's going to happen. Just don't drink today. Mm. Keep it in the day. Do what you got to do today and everything will fall into place. And that calmed my anxiety, because I was like, what about this day? What about that? Nothing ever ends up how you think it's going to be. Mm. Like nothing. Like next week, if I'm about to drive down to mum and dad's now, you know, that road trip's not going to think how it's going to be. Like it's...
Enjoy the journey, bud.
Enjoy the journey, yeah. Be in the moment, like, you know, like, that's what I said, the depression back in the past, anxiety in the future. But when you're in the moment, like I said, I forget what day it is. When I forget what day it is, I'm going really well, because I'm not really focused on the next or what happened yesterday.
Mate, you've got in shorts and shirt, T-shirt today. You got a few tats on you.
Yeah.
Right? I'm interested to know, and our listeners will be very interested to know, what's one that you want to tell us a bit of a story about?
I've got a few. It would have to be this rabbit.
Had to pick it, didn't you?
Oh, no. Well, it's staring at you.
You might just need to stand up so we can see it properly. Nice. You're not flexing your quad there after the run.
I've got that much. I'm just skin and bone.
Tell us about the rabbit.
So,
that one so important for you?
So, it's my journey. It's because I've got a lot of half my tattoos. I'm not really, can't wait to get them all just fixed up and out of there. And it's my journey. It's a rabbit. I'm a rabbito. Kylie Cassidy, so she come through, not come through the Glen, she volunteered at the Glen around the time I started. And she's a Wadjuri woman who helped me do my first bit of Aboriginal art. Never ever got into it because I just didn't know how, or just wasn't really interested. And I did it and I painted something for mum and dad, and first time ever. And so she's known my journey. She's seen me from day one, seen me go through the Glen, transition, like day by day, and she's followed. She knows we've been there since like day dot together, and now she's the COO of the Women's Center. I hope I got that right.
So I think you did.
Yeah. So she's gone here, and then me and her we've sort of gone from like just starting there together. And anyway, so she's a great artist, and I wish I should have brought in this cricket bat that I have. It's she painted it for me in Kookaburra. Tells my journey.
When you get to your parents' place, mate, take a photo if you can.
Yeah,
send it to us.
Yeah, I think I'll put it in storage.
I'll remind you.
Yeah, if I go back there, it's storage before I go home. I know where it is. It is in storage.
Yeah.
So it tells my journey. In the middle, there's the water of dark and young country, the people around me who support me, all the dots, the new beginnings on the neck of the rabbit, and it just represents my story. And she knows, and I didn't even have to tell her what I wanted. She just knew. And then she done it and she painted up and I've got it tatted on me. So that means a lot to me, that rabbit. And so that's my story. And rabbit, of course, the mighty bunnies who are struggling a bit, but we'll get there.
A great story, mate. I didn't know that. And I've met Kylie. She's a wonderful person as well. So, yeah, fantastic.
Yeah, and all the other tattoos, I suppose it means like this is the guy's arm, like my dad's name, my little brother Bowen, and then the girls, my two sisters, my mum, and their star signs. So obviously my real close family,
family means a lot.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So they're amazing. So, and a lot of half other finished tattoos, which
neither here nor there.
They're good at the time.
A different moment of your life.
Exactly right. Mm. Exactly. So,
mate, let's start to wrap this up. What's had the greatest impact on your leadership journey?
I suppose the greatest impact is knowing that I'm a leader, whether I like it or not, that my actions speak a lot louder than what I say or do and how I carry myself. And it just makes me feel good that people do look up to me, and because I'm always about wanting to give back. So, you know, back before the Glen, I used to think leader, like the word leader was like a, you know, do this, do that. But I know it's more like, let me show you how to do this. Let me show you how to do that. And the people that taught me everything, I'm a product of all them. So I've taken bits of everyone, of all the leaders I looked up to. And I hope that my actions and what I do in the future will show that. And then people will sort of take a bit from me and put it into their life. There might be something they don't like. That's cool. Leave that. Take what you believe I said that's right, or what I'm doing is right.
Yeah, well said, mate. Well said. So look, I just want to say I've known you for, I don't know, maybe a bit more than 12 months. And I'm really honored to have you on the show. Absolutely. I've wanted to tell, you know, or to unpack your story, because a lot of what you shared today, I didn't know, but I knew that there was a story. And, you know, with doing what you're doing and where you're going and such an exciting future, you've still got a lot of years ahead of you. You're only 29, as we said at the top of the show. Mate, I'm really impressed with what you're doing now, what you've done through the Glen. Obviously, I've spent a lot of time with Joe and Alex over the time, and they're very impressed with, you know, this man, this person you've become and are going to continue to become into the future. So all well for the IMF. I'm sure you'll do a fantastic job and succeed there. The other thing I have to say, which is what I love working with, you know, getting to know people like yourself that have come through these sort of journeys that are maybe different to a lot of others, but they're your normal to some extent, but there's an extreme level of vulnerability that comes out. And in order to heal and get through things, particularly some of the stuff you shared with us today, you need to have that extreme level of vulnerability. And that underpins leadership in my book. So you're a true leader, mate. Thanks for being a guest on the Culture of Things podcast.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Are you living a life your parents would be proud of? Ethan wasn't, but he sure is now. His parents, brothers and sisters are super proud of the man he's become, especially overcoming the challenges a drug and alcohol addiction can bring. We have all overcome challenges, but overcoming a situation you put yourself into, like addiction, and working your way through to the other side, well, that takes enormous resilience, courage, and support. Ethan had the unwavering support of his family. They believed in him. That belief was strong enough to help get Ethan to believe in himself and design his new life from addiction to sobriety. Do you have the strength to believe in yourself and design the life you want? These were my three key takeaways from my conversation with Ethan. My first key takeaway: leaders find their true self. Ethan lost himself for about 10 years, from a young teenager to his mid-20s. He was a person he didn't want to be, with drugs and alcohol leading him week to week. As he said, he was disconnected from himself. Eventually, he rediscovered his true self and is now living that out. As a true leader, he has worked hard to find his true self. My second key takeaway: leaders ask for help. Asking for help isn't a weakness. It's a sign of strength. When did you last ask for help? It could be something small, or it could be a significant life choice like Ethan had. Do you remember what you were doing on Monday, 8th of January, 2018? Ethan does. He was starting his leadership journey by asking for help. My third key takeaway: leaders elevate others. Ethan's been helping to elevate others over the last 4 years at the Glen. In his words, it's about bringing people back to life, elevating them from addiction to sobriety so they too can experience their family being proud of them. Ethan's walked the path and has used his experience to empathize, support, and lift others out of addiction. True leaders elevate others to achieve their potential. So in summary, my three key takeaways were: leaders find their true self, leaders ask for help, and leaders elevate others. If you want to talk culture, leadership, or teamwork, or have any questions or feedback about the episode, you can leave me a comment on the socials, or you can leave me a voice message at theculturofthings.com. Thanks for joining me, and remember, the best outcome is on the other side of a genuine conversation.
Thank you for listening to the Culture of Things podcast with Brendan Rogers. Please visit brendanrogers.com.au to access the show notes. If you love the Culture of Things podcast, please subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts. And remember, a healthy culture is your competitive advantage.